Greetings and welcome to Mind Matters News. This week, we're continuing our conversation with Dr. Donald Wunsch on his experiences with AI and his recent article in the IEEE Computational Intelligence magazine about artificial general intelligence. This is the fifth part of our conversation with Dr. Wunsch, so if you've not listened to the earlier portions, I'd encourage you to do so. Now, here's your host, Robert J. Marks.
So, Don, we started to talk about the use of AI in weaponry. I wrote a book called The Case for Killer Robots, where I learned a lot about
it. I cited that book in my paper.
Oh, as you should. Okay, thank you. And one of the things that is true is that there are totally autonomous AI systems. They're relatively simple. The one that I remember is the Harpy, which is a missile that is launched by the Israelis. It loiters over a battlefield, just flies around at random, until it is illuminated by radar. After it's illuminated by radar, it knows where the signal came from, and it homes in on the source of the radar and goes and takes out the radar installation in a kamikaze attack, if you will. And this is totally done on artificial intelligence, and it does have the capability of doing this totally autonomously. So you argue that AI is already dangerous, but not because of autonomy. I think autonomy in simple systems is viable. But the reason that we have danger is because of human use. Why is autonomy a red herring in artificial intelligence?
Okay, well, we talked about that a little bit before. So autonomy is a red herring because people do some fear-mongering about AI becoming smarter than us and taking over because it is smarter than us. And so that risk is not zero, but the reason that that risk is not zero is because AI doesn't need to be smarter than us to take over. So that's a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek argument, but it's also got some validity. So that's part of my critique of that, but my more important critique of it being a red herring is that yes, there may be risks that come from AI with increased capabilities. In fact, there are. There are risks from AI with increased capabilities. But there are more salient risks that are here right now. And so, for example, one risk of AI that is here right now is like the type of system that you described. If it were flying low enough to pick up the signal from a police radar scanner that is trying to catch speeders, that's going to be too bad for that cop. You know, it'll come down and it'll destroy his car, and it'll think that it's destroying a radar unit of the opponent in a war, but it actually destroyed an innocent bystander that happened to be generating a radar signal. And, you know, drones have become a source of about the majority of casualties in certain regions of the Ukraine war. And some of these drones are undoubtedly finding other targets. A lot of them are controlled by humans. But there was an interesting article that I cited in my paper that claimed that the Russians were fielding their systems with a great deal of autonomy and not so much concern of whether they're hitting the right targets or not. And so that's by Jane Pinellas and her co-authors, and it's cited in my paper. And Jane Pinellas, she's with Johns Hopkins, but she used to be in charge of all AI acquisition for the entire U.S. military. So she's somebody who's in a position to understand quite a bit about AI policy. So I cited her excellent article, and it was just raising concerns about the willingness of certain geopolitical players to ethically field their AI systems, and was saying that this is a concern because there are entities that do not follow the same rules that we accept as standard rules.
Well, with this, I maintain that there's two types of ethics for engineers. One is the design ethics. We want to make sure that the system we develop does what it is supposed to do and nothing else. Then there is the end use ethics, which is the decisions made, for example, by military commanders. And these are two separate things. The thing about
but they can be intertwined. In other words,
Can be intertwined. Yes, the boundary between the two are indeed fuzzy.
Yeah.
So you discuss AI weapons from drones to policing, and where do you see the hardest ethical line drawing problems in the use of AI weapons?
Well, their proliferation is certainly a big issue. I'd put that as way up there among the issues. So, you have this race to make the drones cheaper and more robust, easier to use, and you know, they're deadly. They're generating a lot of casualties, and maybe the biggest hot war going on right now. And so there's this pressure to get the technology out there.
Right.
But the ability, you know, just yesterday there was this horrific attack on people celebrating Hanukkah in Australia, and they were just using old-fashioned, machine guns or automatic weapons. And due to the action of a selfless hero, it was somebody came in and disarmed one of them, and as a result, the casualties were much lower than they probably would have otherwise been. But, I think that most people of goodwill agree that to hate, much less kill people because of their religious persuasion, is just always morally wrong. And inherently.
Well, this gets to the idea of the definition of a just war.
So a just war is a concept from Augustine wrote about it. And so, you know, was it a just war to stop Hitler from what he was doing? Of course it was. Is it a just war to stop the shipments of drugs across the Caribbean Sea? That's a topic of hot debate right now. Was it a just war for Russia to invade Ukraine? You know, most people in the U.S. would say probably not. Surely people in Ukraine would say probably not or definitely not. You know, and so that's an issue that gets affected by this idea of the boundaries, ethical boundaries around developing AI systems. So if you make something that is effective and cheap, then it is going to be widespread. And so I would say that some of that's inevitable. If you make things that are effective and cheap, but they also have some safeguards built in, then that could be a really beneficial development. So, in other words, if it were impossible for these drones to hit certain types of targets, then that would be, can the drone detect if a drone could detect that a human is below a certain age, if a drone could detect reliably to detect a difference between, say, a family out shopping and a group of soldiers on a mission. That's a really tough nut to crack because, some of these are, like, one part of U.S. doctrine is that there needs to be a human in the loop before a kill decision is made.
Yes.
And that's part of this article is saying, the article by Jane Pinellas that I mentioned is saying, that our opponents are not always using designs like that, but if there were safeguards, is something like that adding value? There's a lot of things that could add value, and on the ethical front, not just on the performance front, but on the ethical.
Yeah, so I think one of the big things is in terms of the design ethics is the vetting to make sure that the system does exactly what it's supposed to do and nothing else. this is a reason I think that the Harpy works well. This is the reason I would have no problems riding in a driverless taxi in Austin, Texas, or San Francisco. And one of the reasons is, as the complexity of a system increases, the ways it can respond go up exponentially. I wrote a paper with this with Sam Haug. And when you have a manageable number of parameters, you can vet the AI. But when you have trillions of parameters, like in the large language models, you can't vet it. It's almost non-vettable. That's the reason we have these things called hallucinations, a word I don't like, by the way, because it anthropomorphizes the AI. I think that you're right in saying that we got to make sure, again, that the AI does what it's supposed to do and nothing else. That it needs to be vetted. Let's talk about another national security situation, which is cybernetics. At Baylor University, the administration makes us all take courses in cybersecurity. They want to make sure we're not phished. And I have learned some things in there. I learned what spear phishing was, which is where they come after you with all your personal information. And that's really kind of weird. But the biggest thing in cybersecurity, as I understand it, is not breaking codes. You can't break a code. Otherwise, Bitcoin wouldn't work because everything is encrypted and you can't break that encryption. So it's always people that are the weak link. So you wrote your paper, which we're talking about, and you said that AI-enabled cybernetics may already have killed people.
Yeah, AI-enabled, not cybernetics. Cybernetics is actually a very positive term. And it's an alternative term to other subsets of AI, Norbert Wiener and so on.
Yes, I'm sorry. I meant to say cyber attacks may have killed people.
Yeah,
yeah, I misspoke.
Yeah. So AI-enabled cyber attacks probably have already caused some deaths. I gave some citations of some fairly early published examples in my paper. But certainly this is a big risk. And so when people talk about risks of AI, I think a lot of the things that get trotted out, like the risk that AI will get smarter than human beings and take over the world, I think are a red herring that take our eye off the ball of real actual demonstrated capabilities of AI to do things that we don't want done. You mentioned spear phishing, and that's a really great example because the burgeoning of large language models makes it less expensive to design attacks that will fool humans. And humans, if not the weakest link, which I think they are, certainly one of the main weak links in cybersecurity is the ability to fool a human into giving you information. And it's so pervasive. And for example, you can get a legitimate email that tells you blah, 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 this or that, click here to do this. Many of these are actually legitimate, but I think that particular type of communication is either going to go through more layers of protection, which is already happening, or it'll just become obsolete to do it that way, because what I'll often do is if I receive such an email telling me to go to my bank or Amazon or brokerage firm or even my employer, if I have the slightest doubt about it, instead of following the link, I will just go to their website that I know and not have the communication initiated to me, but initiated by me, so that I can go to the website myself. I don't need to follow the link in the email and so on. Of course, there are people who know much more about how to protect yourself and the big organizations like my university and Baylor and when I was in the federal government and big companies. They will require you to take training, And it's kind of annoying because they periodically require you to take the same training, but I encourage patience because we can all use reminders, and also the attacks do evolve. And so anyway, but this is a major risk, and the vulnerabilities are tremendous. Some of the actors are funded by large entities like state-funded entities or non-governmental organizations that have a lot of resources, some of them because they're organized crime enterprises that have succeeded in cyber attacks and use those resources to launch even more sophisticated attacks. And so spear phishing is a great example, but it's one of many. And so anyway, that's a good example of misplaced assessment of AI risk versus real world AI risks that actually are proven to exist, known to exist, have already caused damage, and are going to do more damage. And so these are things that deserve countermeasures, attention, and when we know where the attacks came from, consequences as well. So there's several levels of dealing with this type of AI risk that are extremely important. And part of this also is the big players in AI making sure that they take responsibility that goes with the with the resources and the market share they've obtained. So I'm bullish on these companies. I have stock in them. I want them to do well, but I also want them to take responsibility for their positions of influence and power and make sure that they're taking the appropriate precautions against the real risks of AI. And so one of the demonstrated ones relates to cybersecurity. Another one relates to reinforcement learning with the human in the loop. And this is one of the hot areas of research is reinforcement learning with human feedback to have humans help to fine tune the systems to perform better, but also where the system learns to give you more of what you want. But as we hopefully accumulate some wisdom in our life, what we want is not always what we should get. And so using reinforcement learning to rapidly give us more of what we want is actually not healthy for us. And AI is very good at it. And we're belatedly realizing that this caused all sorts of bad effects. And so the companies that, particularly companies that use AI for entertainment, but also AI for news sources, for example, the reinforcement learning can create a vicious cycle which will give you a distorted view of reality or just a distorted use of your time and resources and so on. It can be very damaging. These are some not hypothetical risks of AI. These are already demonstrated system-wide weaknesses that have resulted partly because of the way that AI has been deployed. And it's easy to be a Monday morning quarterback, but without really thinking through the consequences of that deployment.
So you mentioned that, you did some time at the NSF.
Right.
And so you worked for the government and also at your University of Missouri, and you were required to take a course in cybersecurity. I also took a course, as I mentioned, here at Baylor. And one of the things they do, which I appreciate, is they let you take the test first. And if you take the test and you pass it, you don't have to listen to the course. Well, it turns out that all of the questions that they asked for cybersecurity can be answered by ChatGPT. And ChatGPT gave 100% correct answers on the questions about cybersecurity. So I will not admit nor confess. The government gives me the right to remain silent, but not the ability. So.
Yeah, that's a good one. I'm going to remember that line.
Okay, I actually got that from the book by John Edwards, or something about artificial stupidity or something, or do you test positive for stupidity? I think it's a recent book by him, but he mentioned that. Yeah, do you think that we can ever train AI to detect phishing?
Certainly we can deploy AI solutions to these problems. So we could have an AI deployed to detect any variety of, well, I won't say any, but many varieties of cyber attacks that we know exist in the field. But again, we have to look at unintended consequences, because the line of defense can create an opportunity for a vector of attack. So in other words, you could say, okay, I know that these systems are doing this, and so do something that causes that system to make a mistake. Yeah, so there are measures and then countermeasures, and also some of the measures can themselves become a vector of attack, like a denial of service type of situation. So it's and it's just a very challenging problem. There's a lot of things that work that way, and particularly in cyberspace, there's a lot of things where somebody does one thing and somebody does something else, and then the measures and the countermeasures ratchet up. And so, you know, you want to make it more expensive for the opponent to do something you don't like. But then their countermeasures will make your countermeasures less effective. And also there might be a third opponent who figures out some way to exploit what you're doing itself. Another thing that's kind of a standard discussion in cybersecurity, and this is not my primary expertise, but I've done a little bit of publication in the area, and I've talked to some people, and I've had to take these mandatory classes. But one of the tensions is between ease of use and level of security. So you can make systems easier to use by lowering the security barriers, and then people will more seamlessly use the system, but it'll be less secure. Or you can raise the level of security, make it harder to use the system. If you make it enough harder to use the system, people will have workarounds. So a classic example is, you know, a list of passwords in your drawer. Yes. You know, and that's there are some good ways to get around that, but a great thing that has been done with AI, in my opinion, is the things with user consent to use things like voice or video, face, or fingerprint. These technologies have been around for a while, but they've gotten a lot less expensive with AI. So you buy a high-end smartphone and it can do, or probably even a moderate smartphone, you can deal with voice or face or fingerprint, and that gives you another level. And then the multi-factor authentication. That's not as much an AI thing. The other three are certainly using the pattern recognition that we've developed with neural networks, that we as a field have developed with neural networks. So there can and should and will be more of these things.
It seems that legally that everybody should have the equivalent of an NIL, you know, the name, image, and likeness that's given to, for example, college football players. That they own their name, they own their image, they own their likeness. It should
well not
be the
given
same
to them. They partly were born with it, and they partly earned it. In other words, they were born with their name, image, and likeness, and then they earned the fact that somebody wants their name, image, and likeness.
Exactly. So I'm just wondering whether that idea can be extended to us, the population, where we own our name, our image, our likeness, our voice, etc.
Yeah. Well,
it's an interesting idea.
So there are a number of policymakers who have pushed back at the big AI companies for basically leveraging a lot of material, some of which one might have had a reasonable expectation that they would be compensated, or at least their permissions would be sought. And so there's likely to be continued discussion and movement around the policy issues pertaining to privacy and ownership of, you know, to what extent this crosses into intellectual property and so on. And you know, these user agreements that are written by lawyers and are 25 paragraphs long and written in 10-point font that you click on before you can even use websites or software or things like that. What gets put into those may be subject to some change there. So I tend to like a laissez-faire approach to regulation, but there are times when it's really needed, and so what I'm not a fan of the idea of a patchwork of 50 different regulations across the United States, not to mention the territories that our AI firms have to navigate. I do think that it is probably good for the most part to have a federal approach to these issues. But on the other hand, there are things where we have not had our eye on the ball. And the problem is that a lot of politicians can only spell AI if you spot them the A. And they'll be, a lot of them will be the first to admit that. We need to help them with that, and I think that scientists and engineers really can do a lot to help the progress of the field, and indeed in countries where engineers are bigger segments of the population of policymakers and politicians with power. There are what I believe are some more forward-looking approaches to the infrastructure that AI needs. For example, more energy generation capacity is likely to be a difference maker in the field of AI. And China has at least a couple of dozen, I think more than that by now, because this information I heard was more than a year ago, at least a couple of dozen of new nuclear power plants being stood up. And, you know, that was a conversation that I remember from, at least 17 years ago, if not longer, actually longer, about 18 years ago, at the federal level in elections about how should we have 100 more nuclear reactors? And I think we answered that wrong. We should have gone forward if we had 17, 18 years ago committed to 100 more nuclear reactors, they would be all online now. And that could have made a pretty big difference to global warming, carbon footprint, but two, the AI infrastructure is becoming clear is going to make enormous demands, and we really need an all of the above approach to that. So we're straying from the topic cybersecurity, but the intersection with policy is really important. And when I have colleagues that in my engineering encounters who think it's a good idea to construct legal language and share that, I ask them, would they like lawyers designing their engineering systems? And so I think that I have tremendous respect for my attorney colleagues, and I find them just brilliant at wordsmithing a document in a way that nobody could without that specialized training. Scientists and engineers bring a lot to the table too, and these contributions are really important in policy. I think I told you about my news site, my curated AI news website. You put a link to it recently, and I deliberately screen out stuff that has too much hype. But one that I'm going to post, my student may have already posted it for me, came out today on Fidelity Investments. It was a discussion about AI. And some of the stuff they said about AI was nonsense. But when they looked at a business analysis of the companies throughout the whole infrastructure, the AI companies, the energy companies, the other infrastructure companies that are needed to stand up data centers, it just had a lot of valuable information that most computer engineers, computer scientists, AI engineers would not just trot out in an article like that. So I asked the student to post it. It's very multidisciplinary. You have philosophers and ethicists and theologians. You have engineers and computer scientists. You have the Nobel Prize in chemistry was the one of the three that were awarded to neural network people this past year, and so there are people across all sorts of disciplines that have something valuable to contribute. On that website that I mentioned, there's an article by Michael Jordan arguing that you need the economists in the conversation. And a really, really wonderful article. I recommend reading that one very highly. So it has become, and not to mention, of course, the mathematicians have just been absolutely critical to this. So the many disciplines that contribute to the field of AI, that is absolutely an essential part of the picture. And that's part of why I'm the title of that article you referred to, Artificial General Intelligence is Nowhere Near Artificial Specific Stupidity, is already here. The abilities that that go into human intelligence are just extraordinary. And you can get an AI system that can pass the tests that most of the people in most of these professions have to take. But that is not the same. It's not anywhere close to what these people actually do. And so, yes, these systems are going to pick up capabilities that they did not have, that AI systems did not have just a few years ago. But that's not the same as replacing what a human does. That there's so many things that a human does that are just not anywhere near ready for prime time. So one of the earliest critiques that still rings true was by Rodney Brooks, the MIT professor, who was saying that these systems, if they're not embodied, they're missing something that that just can't be replaced. And I agree with that assessment. It goes beyond that, though. I would broaden that critique, and I do in the paper. I say that if a system is claiming to be AGI, artificial general intelligence, and the problem had to be set up so that it would interconnect with the capabilities of a computer, if you had to stack the deck so that a computer can handle it, then that already disqualifies it. So if some urgent thing happened and you had to get up and run out the door or escape out the window or crawl under your desk or call the cops or pull a gun out of your drawer or scissors or a letter opener or something extraordinary happened, humans can handle that. Even a fly, like, have you ever gotten onto a plane or into a car and a fly flies in and you shoo it out, but it doesn't go out, so you shut the door and then it goes hundreds of miles with you?
Yeah.
And then it goes out, and it's not where it was, and it's not going to get back to where it was before it went in there, and it's just going to have to deal with it. And even a fly can do that, right? But if you remove too many assumptions from an AI system and make those assumptions not true anymore, it can be very brittle.
Well, Don, we've strayed far from the initial question about can AI detect phishing. I had a lot of comments on your monologue there, but I think I'll pass on commenting on it because of time elements. Let me ask you this. Have you ever been fished successfully? I have.
Yeah, I have. So that's sort of like so I don't know if you ever met him. George Allen was our dean at Texas Tech a while after I got there. So, of course, okay. long after you graduated. And he had some meetings on campus, and then we had a nice strategic retreat. But I think on the second meeting on campus, fortunately, different from my usual habit, I got in there a little bit early, and somebody came in there a little bit late, and we'd had been having it around the room, and somebody said, "Oh, sorry, I'm late." And he joked, "Oh, that's okay. We were just sharing our most embarrassing moments." the person okay. didn't fall for it, but anyway, but yeah, so yeah, I have fallen for a spearfishing attack too. It purported to come from somebody who I knew, and I just didn't check it carefully enough. But I've also caught some that other folks fell for and alerted them in time before too much more damage was done. So
some of them are very, very good.
Yeah, they're really good. They're getting quite sophisticated. It's no longer that I'm a prince from some different continent and want to transfer $10 million and I just need your help to do it. No, it's a lot more sophisticated than it used to be. And so, yeah, that's why if you're asked to click on something, if you know the place to go, you might go independently there instead of following the link. Yeah.
So we need to come up with a saying, click and don't click. And we need a fancy saying to remind people not to click. So let's work on that. Okay.
Well, and that pertains also not to cybersecurity, but to the other risks that I mentioned, you know, clickbait, you know, something that just, people are trying to steal your time, but they're also trying to steal your money, but people are also trying to steal your time. And so the clickbait problem is a real big one. And so for example, in news, you know, it's very easy to see a headline that makes it look like it's a real story, and you go there, and there isn't anything there. It's something that is designed to hook you in, but you get there, and there's pablum there. You feel yourself get stupider by the minute as you read it, you know. And so that's a pretty big problem with AI, because it will the system will learn things that are more likely to get you to click. And then, so you can get the system. Sometimes you can give it feedback. So I will often give these feedback, and I'll say no more from that source. Like, something that's behind a paywall, and you got to read two sentences of the article, and then you can't read more until you buy it.
Because you got to pay for it. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I'll just tell it, okay, no more from that. No more from that newspaper, no more. Even if I respect the news source, if it's just going to be a clickbait thing, I'll frequently choose the thing that filters it out. So that's not an AI solution, but it was an AI-generated problem. It's a manual solution to a problem that was generated by the AI. In other words, it knows that I like that kind of headline. And then I have to manually punish it for sending me something that is useless to me. So.
Oh, that's great. Thank you, Don. We're talking to Donald C. Wunsch. He's the Mary Kay Finley Missouri Distinguished Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering at Missouri University of Science and Technology, where he is also director of the Kummer Institute Center for Artificial Intelligence and Autonomous Systems. I've known Don for how many years, Don? 30, 35 years or something like that?
I think it's 40 as of this year. Maybe 41. It's between 40 and 41, I think. So, okay. I came back from I came back from a presentation by Robert Heck Nielsen, and there was a group of people who showed up at Boeing when I gave a talk about it. And you were also a speaker at that presentation. And another person who was there was Bernie Widrow.
That was at Boeing, right?
Yeah, I believe I met you and Bernie Widrow at the same day. And you both became important mentors to me afterwards. So anyway, that was really a wonderful day in my life, a very memorable day. And that I think that was the summer... That was the summer of 86, so it will have been 40 years as of this summer, in my opinion.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, I may have met you briefly before that event, but it's at that event that we had a longer conversation. And it was,
I didn't make an impression before that. So, Don, we have known each other longer than the age of most of our students.
That's right. That's right.
That's pretty bad.
And you became my advisor in 1987.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's great. We had a lot of fun.
Yeah, we sure did.
That's it for this week. We'll be back soon with more from Dr. Donald Wunsch. Until then, be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters News with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters News is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters News is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.